From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, keep a pen handy. It's our annual summer book show. It's almost vacation season, which means you're going to need something to read. Maybe you're into nonfiction or biographies, or maybe you've had just enough of reality for now, thank you very much, and you want a big, thick mystery or a novel, or maybe there's something you have in mind for your kids. Whatever it is, we have you covered after this. Hi, podcast listeners. So you probably know we also make short films, and so I just wanted to get you to watch our latest. It's about a U.S. Army soldier, Alyssa Peterson. She conducted interrogations during the most intense moments of the fighting in Iraq. And in 2003, she died by suicide. The film is the story of her brother, Mitch, who wanted to learn what he could about her death. He told us he owed it to her. The film is called Casualties. Go see it at RadioWest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've done a lot of shows over the last 18 years, and some of my favorites have been these book shows, where we gather our book experts, ask them to bring in a stack, and give listeners ideas for gifts or summer reading. And if I'm honest, I like it because it's not quite as much work as a typical show. It's kind of nice to sit back and learn about the new work being done, and we always get ideas for this show. But the other thing I think I like about this is that it always reminds me of that element that I think is going to save a lot of those businesses trying to figure out where they'll end up when all the disruption of the internet settles in. It's that personal interaction with someone who is committed to their work and really knows their stuff. So today in the program, our passionate readers and booksellers are back with us. By now, you know the drill. Get a pen handy. You're going to hear a title you're going to want for your vacation, I promise you. It's our annual summer book show, and we have with us in the studio, as we always do, Catherine Weller, new book buyer for Weller Bookworks. That's at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Kat, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
Ken Sanders back with us, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. Ken Sanders, welcome back to you.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
And Betsy Burton is back with us. She, of course, co-owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. And welcome back to you.
Thank you, Doug.
Well, let me start as I always do. How's it been for books this year so far? Just like start with like the quality. Seeing good stuff so far?
I think I've never seen better nonfiction in my life.
Wow.
Than I've seen this year.
Really?
The nonfiction we just keep, you know, booksellers write the blurbs for our ink slinger. I kept getting blurb after blurb after blurb, and we only blurb things we love. I've never had so many nonfiction books, and good books, fabulous books.
Wow.
There's some good fiction, too, but nonfiction's what
is just... Yeah, I think this is a really powerful spring. It's fall was very good with some standout novels, but the spring is a really strong list. And it is, if you're a nonfiction person, it is a nonfiction reader's delight. The good books run the span. It's not just all current affairs, politics, and economics. The good books are throughout the nonfiction world, which we define by it not being fiction, but it's a world, and there's a lot in it right now.
I had this theory that people are tired of reality and they want something to distract them from what's going on right now. Is that bearing itself out in the titles you're seeing?
Well, they like history.
Yes.
You know, history is comforting, and it teaches you things, but it doesn't threaten your present day, although right. A lot of the history now actually parallels the present day.
Yeah, yeah. What are you saying?
First I want to point out, Doug, 18 years, it's astonishing. The show is in its 18th year.
Yeah, it is.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Perhaps the book shows are some of our favorites too, but I would like to point out it is more work for some of us than others.
And you'll see that in a minute. Yes.
No, well put. I have to agree with both Kat and Betsy that, it is the year of nonfiction. There's a wealth of incredible nonfiction LDS Mormon-themed titles coming out, a lot of just good regional books by regional Utah, Western regional authors. It really is an interesting year for that. It's kind of like we have as many new nonfiction books as we have rainstorms these days.
Oh yes,
one a day.
Okay, that's I love that. All right, let's jump in. Catherine Weller, you start.
Okay, let's start with nonfiction, as is my wont. The first book I have is Real Queer America, LGBT Stories from Red States by Samantha Allen. This book is, it delves into queer America, and it does it almost as a travelogue. This can be read as a travel narrative. Oh. Samantha begins this book with her drive up Provo Canyon to change her clothes because Samantha is a trans woman. And she attended BYU as a different person, a young man. And she began her journey in Provo and continued it when she went to grad school in Georgia. And over again, she had to think about why do I keep living in these states? These states that people don't think of as being queer friendly. And there are lots of people she knew that were asked the same question, and they have answers, and they're really good answers. It's Red America isn't always what we think it is, and being queer in Red America isn't always what we think it is. So this, in the travelogue nature of this book, it's a really nice way to approach it. And that's what I see with a lot of nonfiction right now is context. Looking for context and intersectionality. And this does that. So Real Queer America by Samantha Allen.
Great.
The next one, oh, this book is so heavy. It's from Yale University Press, and they loved the paper. It's called The Club. It's by Leo Damrosch. And it's about Johnson, Boswell, and the Friends Who Shaped an Age. That's the subtitle. It's about a club that was started by Johnson, and actually one of Johnson's friends, who saw that Johnson was feeling very depressed and needed some help getting out of that depression. So they decided to meet weekly, every Friday, at a pub in town to talk about interesting things and tell jokes until midnight and then go home. Wow. And this club is amazing. It is the luminaries of the day. Think of it as the Algonquin round table of the 1700s. Yeah. It wit and storytelling were prized. Intelligence. People joined that club before they were known. And to read a list of the people who are members of that club today, you would just go, oh, my heavens, of course he was in there. But he was in there before he was who he was, including Boswell, for that matter. It is a delightful book to read. The language, the prose, really has a marvelous respect for the language of then and the storytelling and language needs of now. It is a delightful read. Uh-huh. So I highly recommend The Club by Leo Damrosch. Talking about context, The Longest Line on the Map by Eric Rutko is about the building of the Pan-American Highway, which can be seen as a great act of imperialism, a great act of hope, a great act of engineering. It is the engineering feat of America, of the United States, aside from the Panama Canal. And the reasons for that and the way it was done are delved into deeply and fairly readably by Eric. He gets lost in the weeds a bit. I've got to give him that. But it is a delightful sense of this highway that goes all the way from Alaska down to the tip of South America, but for that one boggy part in Panama that we just can't get past to this day.
Say the name again.
I'm sorry. Longest Line on the Map by Eric Rutko.
Got it.
The last one is Red Meat Republic, A Hoof to History Table of How Beef Changed America by Joshua Specht. This can be read as Western history. That's how I read this book. It is the history of the cattle industry, colonization of the West after the Civil War and in the Indian Wars. And if you wonder why meat, beef, a steak is associated with America and manliness and the West, this is the book for you. Highly readable, really interesting. Red Meat Republic by Joshua Specht.
Great. That's on my list. So glad you liked that. Ken Sanders.
Doug Fabrizio. It would be remiss of me not to at least briefly mention your first venture into publishing, Seasons by the late, great Ellen Malloy, in conjunction with Torrey House Press, based on interviews that you did with the late author.
Essays she wrote.
Yeah. Great job. Good work.
She'd gone too soon.
She'd gone way too soon. Yeah. She didn't get a chance to live up to her potential. Thank goodness for what legacy we do have of her, and thanks to you for this book.
Yeah. And can I mention Annie Proulx wrote the foreword
for
this?
Oh, yes, of course you may.
Which is pretty cool. I just think that's terrific. And
well, it shows you what kind of respect.
Well, that's what I mean.
Our own Ellen Molloy gets from a national.
And we reached out to Annie, and she was just a notion, and she immediately responded like, of course, which was terrific.
Anyway, yeah.
So, beautiful.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on. Yes.
So that brings us to the latest, greatest. We all know our Will Bagley, the long-lasting bearded Mormon historian and Western historian, yeah, the author of Blood of the Prophets, the editor of the entire Kingdom of the Saints, which is rounding out with its 16th volume. He's edited them all. They're all, you know, thousand-page masterworks, and he authored half a dozen of them as well. So this is a completely different look for Will Bagley. There's Will on cover in his youth that your audience can't see, of course. Will, back in the early 1970s, built, following his Mark Twain, Samuel Kemlin's dreams of his own youth, he built and paddled his own homemade boat down the Mississippi River all the way to New Orleans. A pretty crazy thing to have done, I think. I'm pretty sure some of those barges on the Mississippi are, let's say, immense. And this here's a photo. It looks like a floating junkyard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. And this is just a marvelously entertaining, different side of the historian Will Bagley, where he literally lets his hair down, and he really had a lot of long, shaggy hair back in those days. And he was skinny, too. Oh, wait a minute. I think I was as well. So this and the skinny Will Bagley will be coming to Ken Sanders Rare Books on 7 p.m. on June 5th to tell us his own impersonation of Huckleberry Finn and Jim.
Oh, that's great.
Down the
River Fever.
River Fever. And he's still got it, I think.
Yeah.
Been writing about it. Switching subjects, there's this new art book series coming out from a British publisher, Thames and Hudson. I want to give you a pop quiz. This book is called Women Artists. Okay, you ready?
Yep.
Can you name more than three prominent women artists? I would submit to you and your listeners, the vast majority of us, after we get past Georgia O'Keeffe, Frida Kahlo, and Mary Cassatt, perhaps, we pause and have a hard time coming up with any more than that. Now, this crowd probably would have to be accepted because there's a lot of knowledge in this room. This series, this one is on women artists. This is on surrealism. It's a whole new series. I think it's a great introductory series for art lovers.
Do you have a name to it? What do we call it?
It's called Art Essentials is the name of the series.
Great.
Thank you.
All right, Betsy Burton, over to you.
Okay, I'm going to talk about a book, nonfiction, that I loved. And as booksellers, we get these things, these advanced reader's copies, and they don't really show us much of anything. Sometimes we just get manuscripts. And so I was reading one of these manuscripts at 2 in the morning, knew nothing about the book except somebody had said I should read it. It was called The Furious Hours. And as I began, it appeared to be true crime of a kind of gripping nature. It was about this preacher, Willie Maxwell, who was also a pulper, I guess, paper pulcher and preacher, who was a handsome guy who had been married about 20 years when his wife died in an accident. Well, this was the kind of the Wild West of the insurance industry. And so insurance, you could buy a policy on anyone, and they didn't have to know that they had it. So Willie took out several policies on his wife, and when she died in this accident, his stories weren't exactly straight, and things were suspicious. They indicted him, but then for lack of evidence, they let him go. They indicted him again, and this time he went to trial. The thing is, his next-door neighbor, who had really given bad evidence against him, suddenly turned, and he got off because of her. And so he got all this insurance money, and then he married her. Yeah. So his brother dies, and there's a policy on him. And then he is married this woman, his neighbor, and she dies interesting, in an accident. And the thing that was really different here was that they couldn't determine, the autopsy couldn't determine what had caused her death. So they couldn't indict him for murder because she died of natural causes. This time he had $100,000+ in insurance. So he really, you know, got the gravy. Well, he married a third time. In the interim, he knocked off a nephew. And then he had this stepdaughter who, you know, was really trying. And she dies. And this time, they're going to get him. By now, he's known across the country. Everybody knows he's a serial killer. They just can't prove it. So there is a trial. And at the trial now, there's Newsweek and the New York Times and all this going on. And there's somebody else in the room, and we're about to hear who.
Here it is from Furious Hours, read by the actor Hilary Huber.
One of the reporters, though, wasn't constrained by a daily deadline. Harper Lee lived in Manhattan, but still spent some of each year in Monroeville, the town where she was born and raised, only 150 miles away from Alex City. 17 years had passed since she'd published To Kill a Mockingbird, and 12 since she'd finished helping her friend Truman Capote report the crime story in Kansas that became In Cold Blood. Now, finally, she was ready to try again. One of the state's best trial lawyers was arguing one of the state's strangest cases, and the state's most famous author was there to write about it. She would spend a year in town investigating the case, and many more turning it into prose. The mystery in the courtroom that day was what would become of the man who shot the Reverend Willie Maxwell. But for decades after the verdict, the mystery was what became of Harper Lee's book.
Wait, so you did you know the Harper Lee part as you were just looking at this manuscript?
I didn't.
That's wild.
And I love the book. It was just a page turner. But then when I got to Harper Lee, it was a whole new thing. And honestly, it's the best book about Harper Lee that exists out there in the world by far.
Wow.
In-depth reporting, really honest research, and I just can't recommend this book highly enough. It's fabulous.
Furious Hours by Casey Sepp. Okay, back to you, Ken Sanders.
As you already know, Doug, the historian and scholar Greg Prince has come out with another blockbuster following his David O. McKay biography of the late LDS Church presidency. He's come out with another barn burner entitled Gay Rights in the Mormon Church: Intended Actions, Unintended Consequences. And it documents pretty much the whole history of the LDS Church's attitudes towards homosexual people. It couldn't be more timely. It just, with everything that's going on in the world today, this is one of the hot button issues of the LDS Church. And until they put a grasp to it, increasingly many, many Mormon families that have gay members are choosing to withdraw their membership because they're choosing family over their church. And I don't think that's a decision that anybody should ever be forced into it. Prince is the perfect person for this. He's not judgmental. He isn't taking sides. He's presenting the history as it's been written down and orally told for, you know, two centuries now. Couldn't be a better book, and you know it well because you've done Greg, and he's a great scholar and writer.
Yeah.
I can't wait for whatever he's up to next.
I know. Yeah, he gets a lot of information. He's great.
Very good at research. And back to our friends at Signature Books, who I forgot to say also published Will Bagley's River book. They've come out with the Presidential Diaries of David O. McKay, 1951 to 1970, called Confidence and Change. It's got a lot of, again, unknown history in it that we, most of us, don't know.
Have you looked at this, by the way? Have you gone into this? It's really interesting. I mean, it's just this. And those who have an affection.
There was a little known coup where Claire Middlemass, David O. McKay's secretary, he was abroad somewhere traveling, and this was in the old days where you didn't have, you know, Instagram and stuff, and she alerted him, and he was able to fly back and stop the very coup that probably would have taken him out of office. It's full of bombshells like that.
Yeah, really,
it's one of the best ones that's come out in years. Then something totally dense, the Salt Lake School of the Prophets, 1867 to 1883.
Listen to how he reads that with such drama.
I can't help myself. This was a secret. Joseph Smith started it back in the Nauvoo days, and Brigham Young revived it, tried to revive it a couple of times, and Wilford Woodruff tried to revive it, but it kept not being so secret. And it spread throughout every Mormon community in greater Mormon country, which is, you know, far beyond the borders of just the state. And it really was a secret government to rule the Mormons from each of these cities, but they kept disbanding it because people kept telling tales out of the School of the Prophets.
Right.
So a great dense history. Salt Lake School of the Prophets, 1867, 1883. And lastly, a new volume of Mormon poetry. Let me read you the title. To the Mormon Newlyweds Who Thought the Belly Button Was Somehow Involved, by Deja Early.
Good title.
I'm just going to leave it at that.
Okay. Okay, Betsy Burton, back to you.
Okay, so now I'm turning to fiction, my favorite, of course, with a book which sadly isn't out yet, but this is summer reading. It comes out July 31st, and I'm happy to say this author is coming to the store on August 16th. Arguably, he is the best American author living today, Richard Russo. Mm-hmm. I think he tells a story like nobody since Dickens. He's compassionate. He knows history. He's the best. And his new book is, for someone of my age, the perfect novel. It takes place in 1969 as they were announcing the lottery, and everybody in America of a certain age, every man was gathered around a television waiting for their number, wanting to know. My husband was one of them. He still tells stories about it. And
I remember those days.
Yes, we all do. So, and three men then they all loved the same woman, but it was really okay because she was engaged to somebody else. They were fast friends. They were together watching the lottery. They were together in a house, and then they scattered to the winds. The woman disappeared completely. So in a way, this reads like a mystery, and half of the book takes place in the present and follows these characters through their lives and as they go back. It's the best look at that era from the point of view not of being in Vietnam, but of being of that age at that time that I have ever read. And it is the best at looking back because that's who we all are now. It's just a brilliant book, and it's the best read, and it's called Chances Are. It's by Richard Russo. So another great read that I absolutely adored is Ask Again Yes, and again, it isn't out now, but this one comes out at the end of the month, so you don't have to wait too long. It's the novel by Mary Beth Keane. Two Irish cops who are friends build houses right next to each other in a suburb, and this book is about their families, and one has in particular a son and one a daughter who fall in love in a Shakespearean way as teenagers, madly and passionately in love. I've never read such a love story as this. They are, but unlike in Shakespeare, unlike Romeo and Juliet, they live on. So it's what happens to them, what happens back and forth with their parents who also were in love and then weren't, and the couples who were friends and then weren't, and what happens over the span of a lifetime. Beautifully written and really a great book.
Say the title again.
It's Ask Again Yes by Mary Beth Keane. Then there's a novel by Mona Awad who was a bookseller for us for a long time, and she's written a book called Bunny. Mona has been a writer. She's never wanted to do anything but write. She went off to, I think, Brown, and she was in a writer's workshop. And this book is the most bizarre take on writer's workshops that you will ever read anywhere. It's about this group of young women that call each other Bunny instead of by their real name. They're the Bunnies. They have no identity. They're all called Bunny. And she just has nothing but contempt for these women until they ask her to join their own workshop. And it's about what happens then to now, Bunny. Yeah. It is inventive, and it does the dirt on writers' workshops like nothing you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And then just briefly, a wonderful novel by Isabella Hammond that told me more about the Middle East and Palestine, starting in its main character falls in love in Paris in, I think, 1914, but then is forced to come home. And over the course of his life, you learn more about Palestine, its birth and its radicalization, than I've ever learned anywhere. It's a brilliant book, and it's called The Parisian, Isabella Hammond.
All right, Catherine, back to you.
So Bryce Andrews, when he came out with his first book several years ago now, Bad Luck Way, knocked my socks off with his young, fresh take on what we call the New West. He moved to Montana to work at a cattle ranch, which was striving to be an ecologically managed cattle ranch. And he proved that, as well as being a person who is very concerned about the environment and a natural cattle rancher, very adept at working on the land, he was a natural writer. He has since come out with this book, Down the Mountain, which is about what happens when a cattle rancher decides he can't keep taking those cows to slaughter. He begins working with a nonprofit group to try to work together that human-wild-animal interface, the apex predators that still coexist in Montana. What we're about to hear is tape about when he went to look at somebody's cornfield, and the rancher says, before you start stringing your electric lines to try to protect my cornfield from bears, take a look at where they're coming from.
Mm. This is Down from the Mountain by Bryce Andrews. Here it's read by the actor Jonathan Todd Ross.
Until that day, the bear tracks that I had run across had been solitary imprints in snow, on logging roads, or in the wet squalor around cattle tanks. I had never walked a grizzly trail, and was caught off guard by its look and feel. The message was complex and foreboding. The trail was broad, its curves smooth and regular as they bent to accommodate hills and swales. It was a well-traveled, unhurried route, an artifact of animals that knew precisely where they were going, were moving at an unhurried pace, and felt no hint of fear. There was something else. Studying the swerving line, I was struck by its familiar quality. It was more like a human trail than anything I had seen. It was a footpath, not a hoofpath, and elsewhere it might have led to a garden, an outhouse, or a place where people like to swim. A foot like my foot, I thought. And in my mind's eye, I could see the wide black pad of a grizzly paw pressing into the ground. Looking toward the mountains, averaging the curves of the path, and taking a bearing straight down their middle, I found myself staring directly at a stand of aspens and dark pines, the timber bumping out from the mountain like the knuckles of a fist. Though it was a small, unremarkable copse, no more than half a mile wide, I knew Millie's Woods at a glance. As I looked across the distance, it seemed impossible that so many bears would favor such a small piece of forest. A few houses were visible, Greg's nearest to me and others hard against the edge of the woods, and I wondered how often the people who lived in them saw grizzlies.
Well, the answer is a lot, because these bears, these apex predators, and I include humans in the phrase apex predator, have discovered corn, and they're coming down into the cornfields and eating farmers' corn, and this is a recipe for disaster for the bears and the people. One of these bears, Millie, through the miracle of modern tracking, he tracks as she comes down with her cubs after waking up. He tracks her to her carrion, and there's just this beautiful line about how she's immediately gorging after waking up from hibernation, eating anything she can find. And he writes about how she consumed entire worlds when she ate this ant colony. It's just, he has this lovely sense of lyricism in his writing as he follows Millie as she walks around and ultimately is shot and has a sad and terrible death. And the last third of the book is them trying to deal with the repercussions of that death, including what to do with her cubs. Wow. It is stirring. It, again, is one of those great books about what happens in the modern West. It's called Down the Mountain by Bryce Andrews.
That is Catherine Weller of the Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square. Ken Sanders is with us from Ken Sanders Rare Books. We have Betsy Burton, of course, from the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake City. And we need to take a break. So we'll be back with more books in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and starting Monday, May 27th, our show is taking a break. After 18 years, we're stepping back to rethink what the show does well and what it could do differently. The plan is to return with a new Radio West at the end of the summer. And until then, you can get updates from me by signing up for our newsletter. It's all at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual summer book show. We have with us our local booksellers, experts, and readers with ideas for your trip to the beach or campground or wherever you're headed this summer. We have with us Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square in Salt Lake City, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, and Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th. Okay, we're on to round three, and Betsy, why don't you begin?
Okay, I'm going to talk about a mix of fiction and nonfiction this time, and they're for fathers, because Father's Day, after all, is coming. So the first one is The British Are Coming. It's by Rick Atkinson. Rick Atkinson is my favorite historian, because he tells history from the point of view of literally everybody on both sides and of every class. He did this with three books about World War II, and this is the first book in a new trilogy about the Revolution. And it is just fabulous. He was one of the few writers who got into Windsor Castle when they opened up King George's papers. So he has all of this wealth of material about King George nobody's ever seen. He covers the Brits who were anti-war back then over there. He covers every race, class, over here. You hear the points of view of everybody involved, including the fact, and this was in this book, we invaded Canada. Now, I'm no history scholar, but I had no idea we'd invaded Canada. I was shocked. This is just a great read, a great piece of history called The British Are Coming, Rick Atkinson. Another great piece of history by another one of my favorite travel writers, actually, but historian too, is Spying on the South by Tony Horowitz. He tracks through the same path as Olmsted, the famous landscape architect who is responsible for Central Park. And, you know, how did he come about this egalitarian point of view and belief that there should be places in the country that are for everyone? Well, it was in part through this tour he took of the South with his brother, where he saw all manner of, well, horrifying, shocking, interesting things. And Horowitz follows in his tracks, sometimes hysterically funny, sometimes very interesting in terms of today, and sometimes fascinating in terms of Olmsted. And it's the two points of view, the then and the now, because Olmsted trip was before the Civil War. And, you know, Horowitz would have it that we're just as riven now as we were then. So fascinating history. And another just wonderful book. And the fact that he's so funny makes it even better.
Say the name again.
The name Spying on the South, Tony Horowitz. And then there is a novel that you can't put down once you start it, I promise, called The River. It's by Peter Heller. You have Running a River, two young men running a river in northern Canada. You have the most almighty fire that they've certainly ever heard of or experienced. You have a killer You have high adventure. You have rapids. You have everything. And literally, you can't put this book down once you start it. And the two friends are absolutely alike in their likes, and they're absolutely different in how they perform in the wilderness and how they look at wilderness. It's just fascinating. And you can't put it down. And then short stories, which I don't always do, but this seemed to me to be perfect for fathers. It's called Lot Stories by Brian Washington. It takes place in Houston. The main character of each of the stories is this young man whose mother was black, father Hispanic, so mixed race. So on one side, there's a family restaurant. There are relatives on both sides. There's a baseball league. There's everything you can imagine. It's edgy. His voice is brilliant, but in a down-home, edgy way. It's just a great read, and I think men and women alike are going to love this book. It's fantastic. It's called Lot by Brian Washington.
Great. Catherine Weller, over to you.
My first book is another nonfiction, a delightful read that I can't not mention, called Greek to Me. It is by Mary Norris, who we know as the Comma Queen, the copy editor for The New Yorker, yeah, who first had her book Between You and Me. This book is slightly different, and it is very personal, but wide-ranging at the same time, as the best memoirs are. This is about Mary's lifelong love of Greek civilization and language and travel. She begins this book writing about how probably delving into mythology and early Greek writings saved her from herself, gave her a bigger, broader view of the world and what people could be. She then goes to New York, does her thing, gets hired at The New Yorker. And this is back in one of the many golden eras of publishing, but the most recent one. And it is the era in which The New Yorker had so much money, they could encourage people to learn and pay for them to do so. So she pursued learning Greek while she was there, both ancient and modern, and they funded it. They also funded a trip for her to go to Greece at least once to further learn about Greek culture and people, because it would help her in her understanding of language and the world. And this book is a delightful trip through Greece. You can read it like a travel narrative, but it also goes into these wonderful details about ancient Greek versus modern Greek, how we've gotten where we are with language, about the alphabet, which I didn't know that's where alphabet came from. It's the first two letters. Just wonderful little factoids if you're a nerd and if you love unselfconscious, joyous writing and lifelong learning. This is a book you will not be disappointed by. It's just wonderful all the way through. Greek to Me by Mary Norris. Next, I've got the arc of this because it releases today, called Riots I Have Known by Ryan Chapman. This is a small epistolatory novel, and I do love modern epistolatory novels. This is written entirely by a man who has barricaded himself in a prison library during a prison riot, which he has unwittingly started with the publication of his prison blog. He is an immigrant from Indonesia, if I'm remembering correctly. And he has that wonderful immigrant's capture of language that is both very precise and colorful and sometimes kind of off sideways. It's just a really wonderful book to read. It's vibrant and pulsing as he's waiting for the prisoners to come break down his barricade and kill him. It's called Riots I Have Known by Brian Chapman. Okay. Next is Rabbits for Food by Binny Kirschenbaum. And I don't think Binny is a stranger to her topic, which is mental illness, extreme mental illness. The narrator of this book, Bunny, our actual character of this book is Bunny, And it opens with her waiting for the therapy dog in the institution and a list of things that are not allowed, shoelaces, pens, et cetera, et cetera. It slowly unravels that she is in a mental institution. She has been institutionalized for crippling depression. And then the narrative switches, so we go back and forth between her crippling depression and the events that led her to being in this mental hospital and seriously considering electroconvulsive therapy and what that will mean to her. It is a really well done novel. It's just not delightful, but it is really well done and very worth reading. Completely different is Daisy Jones and the Six by Taylor Jenkins Reid. And this is just a really light piece of reading that is not at all challenging, but is steeped in music and the music industry. And if you're a fan of alternate narratives, there is no narrative in this book. It's entirely written line by line. It's dialogue. Nothing else is being spoken to a documentarian. So I will say that if you like audiobooks, you can and should buy them from independent booksellers. There is a way we can sell them on our website. And listen to this book, because it is such a good book to listen to on the road. Reading it is not quite as fluid, but listening to it, it's dynamite.
Wow.
It's set in the 60s, gossipy, drugs, sex, and rock and roll.
What's the name again?
Daisy Jones and the Six.
Great. All right, Ken Sanders.
I've been contemplating this hiatus transition coming up with Radio West, so I wanted to do something retro, and of course, you know, I always do something different and oddball. So we're going to go back in time again to the late poet laureate Ken Brewer, who was a lifelong poet and teacher at Utah State University. You guys, of course, know him well. You've interviewed him over the years. And over a nine-month period before he died of pancreatic cancer, he started writing a new kind of poetry and sharing it with his friends and colleagues. We agreed to publish it as a book, and it's called Whale Song, A Poet's Journey into Cancer. And as odd as it seems, if you have loved ones or friends that are have terminal diseases, whether cancer or whatever, this book is an astonishing book of chronologically written poems that change in tenor as the sickness takes him over. But it's a book of faith and hope and belief. And in his dying, Ken Brewer teaches us both how to live and to die. And it would be a great book for anyone facing, you know, great injury or disease in their life. So I want to read you the title poem from Whale Song, A Poet's Journey into Cancer by Ken Brewer. With all this flurry of surgery, all these MRIs and wires down my throat, I begin to realize my anatomy does not match most humans. My stomach is shaped like a J, a fishhook without barbs. My spleen rhymes with baleen, floats out of place, unusually large and irregular. My veins run silent and deep, and not where surgeons expect them. Witness the bruises below both collarbones. Lately, my stomach, my bile duct, my liver, my pancreas are annoyed. I hear gurgling, growling, roaring that suddenly I recognize as whale song. I compare my inner rumblings to an old tape I have. Whale song, no question. I am a whale. I love whales, love their songs, vibrating through their orchestral bodies, out, far, and into the ocean, in all directions. So I sing to all of you, to all the whales, to all the many beings. Love. Love, 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 deep and resonant forever, love.
Wow.
Hey, he read that to us. 2006, Elaine reminded me. Lovely.
Yeah.
OK. Ken, thanks for that. Ken Sanders, Ken Sanders Rare Books. We also have with us Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks and Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop. We'll get to some children's books when we get back from a break. And I should mention, by the way, all of the titles that we're talking about and the ones that we won't get to, because we won't get to all of them. We never do. They're on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio, and our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's our annual summer book show today. We have our local book experts who have stacks scattered on the table, as they always do, here to give you ideas for your summer reading. Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks. We have Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books and Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop. And we are on to children's books now, and we're going to start with Ken.
All right, Doug. We have a new local really fun children's book called The Great, Great Salt Lake, Monster Mystery. It's by Bonnie Baxter and Jamie Butler, writer and illustrator. And it's a really, really fun, well-illustrated, fun little book that teaches children about the real ecosystem of the Great Salt Lake.
Wow.
And we get more out of this than just, you know, the stench of the brine flies and such.
Right.
And it's really, it's a charmingly illustrated and written book that teaches our children about a place that most of us rarely go to or spend any time at. And it's a very complex biosystem out there. And I'm glad to have it available locally.
Say the name of the title really quick.
It's called The Great, Great Salt Lake Monster Mystery, Bonnie Baxter and Jamie Butler. And speaking of, you know, summer and summer travels, I'm off to play Mary Poppins to my grandchildren in London in a couple of weeks. And we just got in this. Of course, it's not a book. Why would it be a book? It's a jigsaw puzzle.
It's
about books, okay?
And he's trying to open it.
It's a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, and it's based on Victorian ornate bound. This is like the era before dust jackets, okay? The late Victorian 1880s, 1890s, when the books had beautiful ornate illustrations. And of these 100 or plus books that you, the listener, cannot see again, every single one of these is a female-oriented heroine, not damsels in distress, but active young girls and women in charge of their lives and their stories.
Cool.
Every single one of these. So I'm going to have a blast taking this to London with my granddaughter Lyra, and hopefully her brother Flynn will get into it as well, even though it's all girls. But he likes the challenge of really good, hard, 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle.
Got it.
And that's all I'm going to do.
Okay. Catherine.
Okay. My first one is a young adult novel called With the Fire on High by Elizabeth Acevedo. She blew onto the scene with her book, The Poet X. This is about a young woman in high school who got pregnant her freshman year and gets to deal with raising that child and people's diminished expectations of her. It's her dream. Finally, she finds her passion, and it is to cook. She goes to a magnet school and gets to do some special programs and apply to a special program, but she's got to learn how to follow the rules and do other things. This is a coming-of-age story for someone you think already came of age when she had a baby. But, of course, no one does. We're coming of age our whole lives. And it is sensitively drawn. It's passionate. It's vibrant with the food and the culture. It's a wonderful young adult novel called With the Fire on High. Dave Eggers has written a book called What Can a Citizen Do? I like his kids' nonfiction, I think, better than the fiction he's writing these days. This is another book like her left foot, that is about citizenry and civics. And it is an empowering, really cool message for kids. It's about how to participate in a democracy, how citizens can be bears or kids, but they can't stay hid, he says. They get to write letters, they get to interact with people, and it's essential that they do so. And it's called What Can a Citizen Do by Dave Eggers.
Great. Betsy.
Okay, well, my favorite picture book of the year is called Sweetie. Now, Sweetie is a naked mole rat. And even as a naked mole rat, she's sort of out of it. She loves fungus mushrooms. She loves interpretive dancing. And she likes to talk about her doll, who is a warrior princess. And nobody that she knows, other naked mole rats, are the least bit interested. So she's very lonely. Until her Aunt Ruth says one day that the best thing about her whole life was the fact that she was different. And Sweetie starts to look for people who maybe share her point of view. Sweetie is wonderful.
Right.
Then for people who love music, Because by Mo Willems and the illustrator Amber Wren is about music, and it's a string of becauses. You know the old thing about it, for want of a nail, the shoe is lost, and et cetera. This is about because Franz Schubert heard Beethoven. He wrote what he wrote, and because members of an orchestra heard that, they became an orchestra, and so on. And so because it's all through this book until finally at the very end, a young woman, by accident, because of a late bus, gets a ticket and falls in love with music and writes a piece of music. It's absolutely wonderful. It's called Because. And then very quickly, a couple of books on outer space, Field Trip to the Moon, which there's not much to say about because there are no words except that it's a field trip of kids. And, of course, they encounter aliens. And then middle reader, called The Planet Earth is Blue, about two sisters who are in foster homes and who are waiting to go watch the Challenger space shuttle, which, of course, is when Krista McAuliffe was killed. It's a very touching book about both of the sisters and what happens, and it really opens the door of space to kids who might not have known about it. It's called Planet Earth is Blue. It's by Nicole Pantelikas. I guess that's right.
Great. Let's do a lightning round. You got a minute. Go. Let's see. Ken, you.
Standing on the Walls of Time, Ancient Art of Utah's Cliffs and Canyons by Kevin Jones.
Kat.
Underland, A Deep Time Journey by Robert McFarlane, published in June.
Betsy.
The Overstory Now in Paper by Richard Powers, my favorite 2 years ago.
Debunking Creation Myths About America's Public Lands by John Leshy.
Working, Researching, Interviewing, Writing by Robert Caro.
Wow.
Warlight by Michael Ondaatje, brand new in paper.
Alone on the Colorado by Harold Leach, 1930s river voyage, alone down the Colorado Green Rivers.
Black Sea, Dispatches and Recipes Through Darkness and Light by Carolyn Eden.
Elizabeth Strout, Anything is Possible, linked short stories.
Gosh, I'm in so in control. I'm just pointing at you guys, and you're just being so good. All right, let's go one more. Go.
People, Power, and Profits, Progressive Capitalism for an Age of Discontent by Joseph Stiglitz.
Horizon by the formidable Barry Lopez.
Great.
Transcription, again new in paperback, by Kate Atkinson, a thriller.
That's Betsy Burton, of course, from King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th. Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. Thank you all very much for joining us. We'll see you again.
Thank you.
That's good. We hope we will.
Yes, you will.
We're depending on it.
Good. All right. Well, and then I should mention, of course, all the titles we got to. And we got to a good amount, but not enough, probably. All of the titles that are on their lists are on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.